Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have an unorthodox podcast guest, me. We thought it would be appreciated and maybe kind of fun to let you, our readers, interview me and ask any questions that have been burning in your mind. So a few weeks ago, we invited you to post your questions on the site, and boy, you have not disappointed. We have so many questions. We'll get through them as best we can. And if we don't get to them all, and if folks enjoy this format, we'll address the rest, plus whatever other ones might come up in the meantime, in a future similar podcast. Your questions are going to be posed to me by Adam Taggart. Many of you know Adam, of course, from the site. He's my business partner and general manager for ChrisMartinson.com. Adam, if you're ready, fire away, but be gentle.
I will, Chris. The bigger question is, are you ready?
I am. I am ready today.
All right. Well, we received a whole bunch of questions, as you mentioned. I think, all in all, we received over 40 submissions, and many of those had multiple questions in them. So we've gone through and tried to distill them down to a little bit more manageable number. We've distilled the questions down as well, but tried to keep the spirit as best we could, too. And what we'll do, as you mentioned, is we'll just power through as many as we can. And if we don't get to all of them, apologies to the folks that whose questions we didn't get to, but we will, as you mentioned, address them in a future podcast. So why don't we start with question number one, which comes to us from user Jag. He asks, how in the world do you write about the same subject matter month after month, year after year, and still make it an interesting read? How do you motivate yourself to write?
This is a good question, and it's there's no easy answer to it, except to say that what keeps me going in this business is that every time I'm writing, I am writing something brand new. What you get from me is I'm looking across the landscape, I'm trying to find dots and connections, things that line up that help to illuminate where we are in this story. And it turns out that at the higher level, we're seeing a very consistent theme here, which is it sounds like we're writing about the same thing over and over again. But boy, are the details ever shifting and changing, and there's always a new configuration. So what you get from me is I put my brain into gear, and I think as hard as I can to come up with something that looks like a unique offering, a new way of looking at the data, a better way of presenting it, a clarification I can make, something I can add to the conversation. And there are days where I wake up wishing that I had one of those services where I update the same charts and tell you a couple of words about it, but that's not what we do. It's not what I do. So the good news is there's plenty of interesting things to write about, and the slight downside to that for me is that I have to wait until I find something really compelling and interesting before I really want to write about it, and then when I do, it's easy. But a great question, and the motivation comes from just knowing that my mission in life is to present information in a way that can help anybody see what's going on and take actions that will hopefully give them a better future.
Good. All right. Well, we're off to a good start here. Now, Jag being Jag, our resident demagogue on the site, he did also, in his question to you, post a brain teaser. I want to let Jag know that we did get the brain teaser. We actually have the answer to it. I'm going to post it online in the comments section, but if anybody here listening to this podcast wants to go there, you can read Jag's question, and then at the end of the comment section, you can see our answer. And Jag, you can tell us if we got it right or not. All right, question number two comes from user Time's a Wasting. How do you process all this never-ending stream of gloomy, frustrating news week after week without getting burned out? And a related question, which user Scubaroo asked, dealing with all this, how do you unplug and switch off from it all? And do you have any plans to come to the UK anytime soon?
I can start with that, with the last part easiest. No plans to come to the UK anytime soon, although it would be wide open to a return visit. I had a great time last time I was there. You know, it does appear to be a never-ending stream of gloomy, frustrating news. It's not, though. These all, to me, represent enormous opportunities to change our lives, to figure out how we want to position ourselves. This is really actually a very exciting period of time. That said, it is I often remark that I wish I was in the business of selling pet rocks or something fun, you know, that people would really enjoy and thank me, you know, thank you, best pet rock I ever had, because I am in the business of telling people about things that can be perceived as or received as gloomy or in some way frustrating or those other descriptors. And so what I do is this year, 2011 and starting in 2012, was a big period of adjustment for me because I spent 5 or 6 years just glued to what I was doing. Ended up getting a little overweight and you know, not really taking good care of myself. So 2011 marked a turning point for me where, this was important to keep me from burning out just because of the pace of what I was doing, not necessarily the gloominess of it. I really had to start taking care of myself better and getting back into physical shape. And it's been I'm so glad I've done that. I have a lot more energy. I've lost pretty close to 40 pounds in a pant size that was last seen sometime in high school. I feel a lot better. And so I'm out there. I'm rock climbing again pretty regularly in a gym. Don't worry, very safe. Gardening, orcharding, just getting out, biking, whatever. I've found that really attending to my physical body was the most important thing I needed to do, and it's a great way of working out a little frustration if I happen to have any. But overall, it's also necessary, I think, given what I see coming, to be in the best shape I can be in. So that was my strategy so far, and I'm sticking with it, and it feels good.
Good. Well, as someone, I mean, I think, Chris, we've been working together now for a little bit over a year and a half. As someone who's watched you go through that transformation in that time period, I can definitely comment on how noticeable the change is. It's really quite impressive, not just the weight you've lost, but the level of fitness that you've attained. And one of the things I know a lot of the folks on the site appreciate, but certainly I do, somebody who works really closely with you, is, you know, when you're talking about transformation at the personal level, you know, you're walking your talk.
I can't do it any other way. If I haven't done it, bought it, tasted it, I can't recommend it or talk about it. It's a question of integrity for me. So this was something I had to do. I had to do it for myself, and I felt like I had to do it as well as a matter of integrity if I'm going to talk about how important it is to do.
All right. Next question comes from user R. His or her question is, how would you revise the crash course in light of recent developments in the extraction of natural gas in North America and elsewhere? Is it possible that in the years ahead we will see a transition from an oil-based to a natural gas-based energy economy? We received a couple other similar questions around this, some of them dealing with shale oil deposit discoveries as well. So why don't we start with that one?
Okay, well, the short answer is it would change a lot in my timing of what's going to transpire if I saw that we were engaged in North America in a credible program to actually utilize that natural gas. This comes up a lot because it's all over the newspapers about how much there is, and it's on the airwaves, and we've just got these tremendous shale gas reserves, and the flow rates have now exceeded demand to the point that we've driven natural gas down about 250 per therm. And so it seems like all the data says, wow, there's a lot of natural gas, and it's important to put that in context. The amount of natural gas that we compress and then use to transport things from point A to point B, that's how we use 70% of all the oil that comes out of the ground. It goes straight into gas tanks or diesel tanks. Well, it goes through a refiner first, but I mean, that's going from ground to gas tanks, fuel tanks, and then being used to transport things. We do not use natural gas to transport all that much. If and when we get serious about this, you'll know it, because we're going to be building pipelines so that we can transport the natural gas from the fields to all corners of the country, particularly the East Coast, which is really poorly served by natural gas lines at this point. And then from there into filling stations, which have all been retrofitted so that, you know, the average bloke on Monday morning can safely use a compressed natural gas filling device without blowing up the whole neighborhood. Yep, that's important. And we'll have cars and trucks that actually run on compressed natural gas. There's a few, but I mean, it's token. Not even a percent at this point. When we're up to 10%, when we're at 20%, when 50% of the fleet is operating on compressed natural gas, we will discover, prediction time here, that we do not have nearly as much as we thought. And it's simply that we have an incredible amount of natural gas, read the asterisks at the bottom of the page, at current rates of consumption. When we dial consumption up, we'll discover we have slightly less than we thought. Should natural gas be an important bridge fuel? Absolutely. No question about it. over the long time frame, 100 years, 1,000 years, well, I can just go with 100, 50 even, over 50 years, does natural gas appreciably change the story in terms of its direction? The answer is no. It's a non-renewable natural resource. You pull it out of the ground, you burn it once, and it's gone. My position would be we're going to use it, and we should use it, and we should use it as carefully as we possibly can as the bridge fuel that helps us transition away from a peak in oil to, whatever that new future, energy future happens to be. And I don't care what that is. We can say that's alternative energies like solar, wind, or maybe this low energy nuclear reaction thing pans out, or there's some other thing that we don't know about that comes along. But it takes so long to transition from one type of energy to another that I do not yet see that we have an investment a resource dedication approach in this country yet that says we're being serious about using it that way.
Great. A related question is, the Crash Course was written and initially put online in 2008. Is there going to be an updated version of the Crash Course getting published anytime soon? I do want to give folks a little bit of nod that we're spending a lot of time right now, in addition to our site redesign that we've let everybody know about, that we are creating a fair amount of new video content this year. Do you want to give just a quick 30-second about that?
So we have updating the Crash Course is absolutely on a very long list of things we want to do. And when we look at it, it's not right at the top at this moment. There's some other video material and other content that is a little bit more urgent given where we are in this story. The core of the Crash Course itself, the main thesis around how money or the economy, how energy and the environment are all coalescing, that doesn't need any updating at all. The 20% that does is, getting the charts back up to speed, with current data in there going beyond 2008, now into 2012. There were some pieces in there we think we could leave out without affecting the story so we could tighten it up. There's some new pieces we'd like to put in as well. But the pieces we really want to bring forward to you are what we would consider to be chapters 21, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. We've got additional material that builds on and augments the Crash Course. And when we ask ourselves or when we ask other people which we should really be working on, fixing chapters 1 through 20 or coming out with 21 through 26, it's unequivocally, please, can we have 21 through 26? So that's where we're going to put our first efforts. But along the way, we definitely have our eye on where, when, and how we can update the Crash Course. Thankfully, a lot of sharp eyes have been out there in the comments section in the forums under each of the chapters. There have been excellent comments on how to improve, minor errata that's been discovered, other things that really need attending to. So we've got all of that captured, and it's just a project awaiting some resources to get it done.
Great. All right. Now from user Thatchmo. If you were suddenly magically made president of the United States, what would you do, or could you do, practically within the powers of the office, which, according to the recent office holders, they claim are pretty much unlimited, to steer us to as soft a landing as possible in our predicament?
Well, the first thing is related to the natural gas question. I would wave my magic policy wand, and we would be starting to build out our ability to utilize natural gas in terms of transportation and also to build out our next energy infrastructure. We would stop burning hydrocarbons for anything that was non-essential. And one of the things that I care most about is we can use the sun to heat water. We should not be heating water in electric hot water heaters, natural gas-fired hot water heaters, or oil-based hot water heaters if we don't have to. And for most cases, we don't have to. So there are a number of things we could do to simply slow down our burning of energy in a way that really is only eliminating the wasteful burning of energy. And at the same time, we're creating domestic industries. There's the manufacturing industry of the solar thermal panels, if we were going to do that, or the development of the natural gas pipelines and filling stations, all of that. Those are all devices that need to be manufactured. There are people who need to install them. There are people who need to maintain them. There's actually quite a number of jobs around that and good jobs. The other thing would be around our use of food and particularly soil and soil building. I would put as much money as I could towards the type of farming that Joel Salatin is doing or the wonderful people I know who are involved in permaculture. These are desperately under-supported areas right now in terms of funding and resources. It might as well be zero for all practical purposes. It ought to be a lot higher than that. And there are a number of things that I would additionally do around one of the things that's really incredible about the United States is we've got just outrageous amount of inventiveness and creativity. I would start a national program with like, let's put some meaningful number in there, $1 billion. What's that? About 3 hours of Fed printing at this point.
Right.
Let's take $1 billion and structure it out as a prize for whoever, whatever company, whatever individual can solve some aspect of battery storage, to create a higher density. There are VC firms that, looking at that prize, looking at a suite of potential battery technologies out there, would commit more capital and give it to the right people, I'm convinced, to chase after a prize like that. Because look what happened with the X Prize. $10 million. That's all it took to incentivize about $100 million of investment to get us privately into outer space. That's a fraction of what NASA got us there for, and now it's actually a viable industry of sorts, small, but they're talking about space tourism flights, and that was sort of the power of a prize. These are the kinds of things a president could do. I think just with the bully pulpit and bending a few arms, those are within the possible. The thing that really needs doing is the predicament needs to be outlined clearly, lucidly, in an adult-sized way by a leader with vision who can say, here's where we are. We might wish we're otherwise, but here we are, and here's where we need to go. So here's my plan for getting from point A to point B. And the office of the president needs to operate like a CEO. That is, they should be out there with the vision and holding that vision and helping us get there. More often than not, the president recently has become the COO, in my mind. They come out with tactics and strategies, and here's a program, and here's a list of this, and we should do some of that, and a few of these, and Now, I think if I was president of the United States, if I was POTUS, I would be outlining very clearly where we are, where we need to go, and I'd be asking the country to figure out how to get there. That's the right position for the president, I think.
Okay. Well, there still is time before the November elections to have a new person throw their hat in the ring. Any announcements you want to make for the listeners, Chris?
I believe Thatchmo is up for this role. Person who asked the question.
All right, Steve, ball's in your court. All right, Nick Burt asks, are there any key go-to information sources that you tend to check for signs of imminent problems each day, or especially when you're out traveling?
Yes, absolutely. I'm constantly checking the price of gold, oil, stock markets, treasuries, credit default swap spreads. I'm looking at corporate debt, junk debt. So I've just got a variety of sites that I use. Some are public, some are through the brokerage houses I use. So I'm constantly looking for those. If I see a huge jump in any one of those markets, I'm then going to go fishing around for information. One of the first places I go is one of the wire feeds through Dow Jones, maybe, which comes, again, through one of my brokerages, because those tend to be very, very current in terms of getting all sorts of rumors and updated news out. Then I check Zero Hedge. It's an amazing site. It's remarkable how fast that site gets on some of the news. I'm really impressed with that.
Yeah, Tyler's incredible.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. And then I have a number of other blogs I check, but if it's really critical and urgent, I'm looking for the fastest information I can get to. What I don't do is I'm not checking the majors, the big newspapers online, or I'm not going to TV hoping there's going to be good information there. Those are not sources for me. And then if I've gone through all of that and I decide there's anything so urgent that I have to quickly write something up and or send out an alert, that's what I'll do next. So, yeah, I'm really watching the markets as my first early warning indicator. And I should note that when I sent out the big warning in 2008, which now we know in retrospect was actually a very good warning to be giving about a potential collapse of the banking system, what alerted me to that was watching credit default spreads blowing out on a number of major institutions. That was my first warning sign. And that came about a week and a half to 2 weeks before the actual true event unfolded.
Okay, great. Well, one little commercial I'll make, too, is that with the new site that we'll be launching in 2 months, we'll be adding essentially a data dashboard on the site for a lot of the most common sources that you mentioned that you look at. So if folks want to be looking at the same types of data that you're looking at on a regular basis, we'll have that dashboard in place.
Oh, I can't wait for that. So Yeah, folks, this is putting together the one place, the one page for all of the stuff that I just mentioned, that because I want it all in one place myself rather than having to fish around and maintain a bunch of sites. So we decided and entered an arrangement with a company that can help provide that for us so that we can deliver that all at once. And hopefully there'll be opportunity in a downstream version where we can add a little color commentary around it so that maybe a pop-up box or something, some note that can be attached where I can tell you why I'm looking at this indicator and what it means to me that it's moved this much. So that I don't believe is going to be in the first iteration, but that's the direction we're trying to go to, is find ways to get you the same information I look at with enough context so that it's useful to you.
Great. All right, next question comes from Ravi Nathan. Are there options for investing in precious metals that you can suggest for people with IRAs and 401ks that are trustworthy and hold unencumbered and allocated units? I think Ravi and a lot of other people who submitted similar questions, they're just concerned that, you know, the ETFs like GLD, SLV have too much counterparty risk, and other options out there like some of the spot funds come at a pretty high premium.
There are excellent companies you can use. I cannot for legal reasons say who they are. But the financial advisory and management firms that we most trust can address those specifically and very completely. The general answer is yes, there are fully unencumbered allocated options out there with custodial firms that can hold your 401k or IRA assets in physical bullion. I absolutely recommend that as the first order of business. I'm a little less concerned with the high premium on the physical, like Sprott's. I really trust the Sprott funds in terms of, you know, they have what they say they have. The premiums have been there long enough that I kind of think that they look permanent at this point in time. And maybe not always as high as they currently are, but I think if you bought at a premium, you can be reasonable. Well, over the past year and a half, you could have sold at a premium too. So those sort of canceled out a little bit. And I fully share the concerns around the ETFs themselves. And I absolutely think that any firm that you do use, particularly after what we saw with MF Global, you have to be clear around really what the arrangement is, the legal arrangement is around the firm that you're going to use. You know, is it insured? Are they actually holding it in custody? You know, if the parent company goes broke, what happens to the assets underneath? Do they get stuck in some horrible discovery process that goes through, you know, some sort of a trustee arrangement afterwards, or are they actually yours? And these are all things that a competent advisory firm can talk to you about, and they will, and they should. Here's how you know if you've got a bad advisory firm. You start talking to them about these things, and they act as if you're asking silly, inane questions that really nobody asks, or otherwise try to put you off. These are important questions. Everybody should be asking them. Anybody that steers you to the idea that these are not relevant or important or somehow a little out of line is not the right firm for you in this point of time. It's MF Global taught us that.
Yep. It's probably worth noting here for our listeners, Chris, that we did near the end of last year identify one particular advisory firm that we have gotten to a point of comfort in recommending to people who are looking for a financial advisor that sees things, sees the world through a similar lens as we do here through the framework of the Crash Course. Anything you want to mention to folks about that?
This firm manages a lot of my family's money. We do currently have an arrangement with them whereby if we direct a new client to them that funds with them, that we will, over here at chrismartinson.com, receive compensation for that referral. And that compensation in no way affects the fee that you would pay if you join them. But in full disclosure, I do need to mention that that we have formalized an arrangement with them that does provide a win for us. It provides a win for the firm, and we believe really provides a win for the clients as well. And as I mentioned, this is where my family is very comfortable with this firm at this point.
Great, and you know, I've heard you say this to folks in the past. The most important thing that we recommend folks do is they find a financial advisor that truly fits their needs, is going to treat them in the way that they want to be treated as an account. At the end of the day, we don't really necessarily care whether they go with the firm that we have recommended or not, but we want to make sure that people are at least putting their money that they want financial assistance with a firm that they feel is going to be a good steward of that. I will say, if there's anybody listening that wants to have more information about the firm that we've begun directing people to, feel free just to email us at support@chrismartinson.com. All right, let me get to the next question here. Next question comes from user LittleFeetFan. How big of a threat is global warming in your models? Or as put by the forum thread, this is one of the ones that's more active on the site, is global warming still worth brushing off?
You know, global warming is something that we've not put front and center in our set of concerns, and there's a couple big reasons for that. Not that it isn't a concern, but here's the biggest reason. We've learned, and Dan Ariely, if you want to listen to an incredible podcast from a while back, I believe we got that, came out in early 2011, is around behavioral economics. And behavioral economics says that humans are predictably irrational, and that one of the ways that humans can really be counted on to behave in a certain way is that we tend to react to threats that are clear and immediate over ones that happen to be a little bit more distant and nebulous. You know, this explains smoking behavior, for instance. You know, a lot of people wouldn't drive a stock car at 200 miles an hour, but they'll smoke. They may have the same risk factor over time, but it turns out that one's near and clear and immediate and obvious, and the other's not. It's longer term and nebulous. We discovered that global warming is very, very good at motivating an incredibly small number of people to take actions. For most people, it is just not a solid enough threat for them to say, here's what I'm going to do that's different as a consequence of that. And we are agnostic as to why people take action. So if we end up getting two families to take the same actions, they both end up using half the fuel. One family is doing it because they believe in global warming, and the other family is doing it because they happen to believe that it builds extra resilience into their lives because they believe in peak oil. We are agnostic as to why people end up burning half the oil in this particular scenario. What we found is that in approaching what we do through the economy and looking at the energy situation and understanding where we are in the resource story around the environment, that those are ways that we can approach this conversation and have a large number of people take very concrete, definitive actions. That's our metric for success. Have people taken information and used it to make substantive changes in their lives that we can see, touch, and feel. That's what we care about. The second thing is that at our site, it's an internet site, and one of the things we've learned through the School of Hard Knocks on the internet is that emotional material is very difficult to handle on an anonymous site where people get to sign in with an anonymous screen name. There's no human interaction in terms of facial expressions and things, you know, flame wars, all this and that, are very easy to get going on websites. And we wanted to create a place which had a very different tenor, a very different feel. We're talking about difficult material. We're asking people to entertain very challenging thoughts around what the future might look like. So that means our environment at our site needs to be safe, needs to be welcoming, needs to be inviting. Flame wars are none of those things. And what we discovered, again, through the School of Hard Knocks was that of all the people coming to our site to discuss global warming, none of them were climate scientists, almost none of them, very few, just a couple. Everybody had a very strong emotional belief about it, and whether it was for or against the idea. And those beliefs led to very uncomfortable conversations, name-calling, a general degradation of civility, and other things that we felt were working cross-purposes to the larger mission of the site, which is to get as many people as we can, actually everybody if we can, to look at this material, think about it, discuss it, whether they agree with it or not, or discount it, or embrace it entirely. You know, our mission is to get the conversation going. And unfortunately for us, we discovered that global warming was a limiter of that conversation, not an enhancer. And we looked around the web and decided there were lots of places people could go to have that conversation as many times as they want and in any way that they wanted to have it. But at our site, we really decided that there were other things in our models, as the question was framed, that were better and a little bit more reliable at creating the type of action and the type of conversation we most wanted to have.
And as you've said before, too, most of the strategies that we talk about and would deploy to address the peak oil threat on a national or global level would be ones that you would deploy anyways for fighting something like global warming. And so, you know, we're actually focusing on a lot of things that are to the extent there is a global warming threat, will be constructively positive in dealing for it anyways.
They're exactly the same. In both instances, we're talking about reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that goes in the atmosphere. But in the way that we're approaching it, we're asking people to do it because it makes economic sense, because it fits in the context of the peak oil story, because it's very immediate, and it's something we can really get our hands around and how it builds resilience. So, yes, again, we're agnostic as to how the actions, the rationale for why the actions get taken. A simple example, my next door neighbor has planted fruit trees because he saw me doing it. And he's an older gentleman. He thought his wife liked the flowers on them in the spring. That's fine. I'm agnostic as to whether they're going to increase the food resilience in my community, which is my motivation. Theirs happens to be different. But we're both planting fruit trees. That's what I care about at the end of the day.
All right. Our next question is another common one that we've heard as people try to help build awareness and educate others about the 3E forces. A lot of those people might not be ready yet to hear that message. So the question from user, here we go, is, as you become more experienced in delivering the Crash Course message to new audiences, can you share the common sticking places that crop up in people's thinking and how you work with them?
Yes, this is a constant source of development and artistry. I wish we had a science around this at this point. We've learned some things, and maybe we could call that science, but still there's a lot of art to this. And the basic idea here is that the Crash Course message is one of really big change, and that raises a lot of uncomfortable issues for a lot of people. And what we've learned through the School of Hard Knocks, again, is that for people who are not yet ready to hear this message, they're not yet ready to hear this message. There's no way to reach them with additional data or better phrasing or by, you know, holding back something or enhancing some other part. When people are ready to hear this message, they're ready to hear it. And so part one of this story is around how to let go of needing everybody to hear your message. And in the letting go of, this is where you become a lot more effective. I become a lot more effective. This is something I talked about with James Dines in a podcast just a week ago, is that if you can approach this material with an attitude of literal unattachment as to whether your audience believes you or doesn't believe you or cares about it or runs off and becomes busy, just deliver the material as dispassionately as you can, as with as few of your beliefs as you can, and you have a much better chance of getting it across. Now, the sticking points are obvious. The sticking points are around the major belief structures that people hold. Here's the biggest one. It's faith in technology. Technology is going to come along and is going to save us. And there's always some version of that objection, if I could call it that, that comes up. It comes up quite often. A second one that comes up quite often that's just behind that is, yes, but I think you're really underselling how clever humans are. We've solved many big problems in the past. This sounds like a big problem. We'll solve it. Both those are true. Technology is going to play a role, and we will, one way or the other, get through this. Whether we get through this elegantly or inelegantly, I think that's still up for debate. But what I've found is that there are a very common series of objections that tend to come up, and we can map all of those objections back to a belief structure. And it's the belief structure we need to work with, not the objection itself. And so there are ways to do that, and a lot of things that I've learned around how to do that. This is something that we are going to be talking about, and we do spend a lot of time on in the seminars that I give. We've got one coming up at Roe in Roe, Mass. In March 23rd through 25th, and we've got another one coming up at the Kripalu Center in June. And I believe, is that June 21st? Somewhere right around there. And so both of those seminars are places where we deal not only with this question sort of generally, which is, you know, as you bring this to audiences, but much more specifically, what do you do when you've got a significant other, a spouse, a partner, a colleague, a friend, a coworker who is who you want to carry this message to, who is reluctant, we might say, in receiving this message? There are a lot of ways that we can help coach you through that, and which we do cover in the seminar.
Great. And just to clarify for folks, the dates for Kripalu are actually June 29th through July 1st.
That's it. Thank you.
Yep. All right. So just doing a time check, we are not even halfway through the questions that we had prepared for this call. So I think we're definitely going to have to break this call into two separate podcasts. So I'm going to ask you just a couple, probably two more questions or so, and then we will wrap things up until next time.
All right.
So next question comes from SafeRight. How did your decision to take the red pill affect your relationships? Did you come under criticism for quitting your job, selling your house, and changing your lifestyle? And how are your children taking this?
So the red pill, for the few people who don't know that reference, it comes from the movie The Matrix. And after you take the red pill, you see a version of reality and you can't ever see the old version again. It's gone. You understand a reality in a whole new way. And so the red pill in this story was once I started to wear this point of view, put it on and wore this point of view, which looked at the world through the 3E lens, it changed everything for me. It changed my job, where I work, who my friends are, everything. And at first, how did it affect my relationships? My friends and family thought I was nuts. No question about it. My broker was absolutely convinced I was thoroughly nuts. I was doing silly stuff. I was buying gold, you know, and this was back when gold was,
crazy,
300 an ounce and had been going nowhere for 2 decades. It was certifiably insane. So it affected a lot of my relationships, but it's not as one way as it sounds. The people who used to be my friends at that point in time kind of lost interest in me, and I kind of lost interest in some of them as well, because we parted ways. I started to see the world differently, and what interested me, what motivated me, what concerned me, what brought me joy were all very, very different from what they used to be. A couple of quick examples. I've absolutely sort of lost my thread on sports. Really, really drove me hard. I was, I could have told you all the stats on the Duke basketball team where I used to go, and football teams and all of that. And somehow I find myself less concerned with things that used to be really passionate for me. So it shifted a lot in my life personally. Yeah, it came under a lot of criticism, and some of it was internal criticism, because I did a very silly thing. At the age of 42, I quit a vice presidency with no clear idea of what was next. I had 3 young children at that point in time. It was not a very smart move by conventional standards, but it was something I simply had to do. And because there was that sort of missionary zeal for me at the beginning, I think that also colored some of the relationships for me, where people looked at it, didn't understand it, maybe hadn't had a passion that strong in their lives, so that was another way they didn't quite understand it. But this was something I really didn't ever really question all that hard at the time, or even looking back on it. How are my children taking this? Well, they are some of the most well-adjusted, happy people I know, and I love the feedback we get from the world about the kinds of individuals they happen to be. They just, like kids do, they just incorporated all of this into their framework from a very early age. This is just how life is for them. It's not something where they had one point of view and then it got shooken up and now they have a different point of view and that was a semi-traumatic sort of a shakeup for them. This is just how life has been.
All right. And having met your kids, I can completely agree with the feedback you get from your community. They are wonderful kids. All right, last question. I'm going to jump down here, Chris, simply because it's a timely one, given the fact that I don't know how many presidential debates have been on TV recently, but I think we're in the teens. Do you believe that people in high political offices are aware of the coming crises that we talk about on our site, but intentionally don't address them? Because the solutions necessary to ameliorate the problems would be so painful that they would destroy any chance of reelection. And we'll make that our last question.
Yes, this is absolutely the case. I've had opportunities to talk with not just politicians, but individuals who you would consider to be very highly placed, CEOs of very large companies, people who are worth a lot of money, who are very well connected, and they are all highly aware of what the risks are and what's really at stake. And so this is one of the largest disconnects that exists in our country right now, is the disconnect between what you hear coming out of politicians' mouths and other leaders' mouths at this particular point in time, what you're reading about, how they express their motivations and concerns for the future in terms of their actions, which bills are they supporting, where are they proposing to put money. The gap between all of those sort of ideas, monies, and resources and priorities and what you know to be true, and honestly what they know to be true, is enormous, and it's growing. And it's in that gap where we find that discomfort that everybody feels like, oh, this country's really on the wrong track. It's Congress's 9% approval rating. That's not just that people don't approve of, which bills they're passing. It's they don't approve of which bills are passing, given where we really are in this story. That's an enormous source of concern, and anything I could do to convince people or cajole or in some way help people understand that the very last thing you should be doing is relying on or waiting for Congress to somehow figure this out, ride to the rescue, and get it right. They're just not going to do that anytime soon, is my personal belief after having watched for a decade now. Things continue to trundle in a very predictable, very obvious direction, which I know they know about, and yet they're doing things which are so fundamentally out of alignment with that trajectory that you might as well be occupying a different parallel universe. And so that's my own personal belief. It's always possible we'll elect the right person, maybe the right president will get in, or somehow this will shift, but that's a hope. And in my own personal framework, the much more likely outcome for this is that there will be a crisis. It'll be pretty significant. It'll precipitate the necessary changes. Will politicians come around at that point in time and start proposing things that make sense? Of course. The question really remains is what condition will the country be in at that point? What resources do we have? What options are available? And with respect to those last two, the options and resources, guaranteed, they will not be as robust or as rich or as inexpensive as they are today. There'll be some smaller set of less palatable things that we'll have to choose. And if you want a model for that, if you want to know why I'm saying what I'm saying, just start reading more about Greece. Yeah. Look at Greece's options, look at their opportunities, compare them to what they could have done 2 or 3 years ago, and you will see a very, very different set of available outcomes for them at this stage compared to then.
Well, as sobering as that is, I think it's very accurate. Well, Chris, you're off the hook. We've made it through the questions. We're going to make it through in this initial podcast interview of you yourself. We will plan to address the other questions, and I'll also give folks a chance to post new ones on the site in a future interview.
Well,
my pleasure.
If you tell people to ask questions that I can answer with a yes or a no, we can get through more of them.
I'm sure we could.
All right. Well, thanks, Adam. This has been fun.
It has been fun, Chris. Look forward to doing it again.
All right.
Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.